का श्रीमद् भागवतम कैंटो 11 चैप्टर 3 टेक्स्ट 21 तस्मात् गुरुं प्रपद्येत गुरुं प्रपद्येत जिज्ञासुश्रेयोत्तमम् शब्दे परे च निष्णातम् ब्रह्मण्योपसमाश्रयम् तस्मात् गुरुं प्रपद्येत जिज्ञासुश्रेयोत्तमम् शब्दे परे च निष्णातम् ब्रह्मण्योपसमाश्रयम् तस्मात् गुरुं प्रपद्येत जिज्ञासुश्रेयोत्तमम् शब्दे परे च निष्णातम् ब्रह्मण्योपसमाश्रयम् Therefore, Gurum, a spiritual master, Prapadyet, one should take shelter of Jigyasuhu, being inquisitive, Shreya Uttamam, about the highest good, Shabde, in the Vedas. Pare, in the Supreme, Cha, and Nishnatam, perfectly knowledgeable, Brahmani. In these two aspects of the Absolute Truth, Upasamashrayam, fixed in detachment from material affairs. Translation and purport by the followers of Srila Prabhupada. Translation: therefore, any person who seriously desires real happiness must seek a bona fide spiritual master and take shelter of him by initiation. The qualification of the bona fide guru is that he has realized the conclusions of the scriptures by deliberation and is able to convince others of these conclusions. Such great personalities who have taken shelter of the Supreme Godhead, leaving aside all considerations, should be understood to be bona fide spiritual masters. So I'll read the last part of the purport. The earlier parts have been taken in the previous classes. According to Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, one who has understood the futility of material existence can approach a bona fide spiritual master. In the two previous verses, the futility of earthly and heavenly sense gratification has been described. Now the natural conclusion is that one who has understood this should approach a bona fide spiritual master. The bona fide spiritual master broadcasts the sound vibration from the spiritual planets called Vaikuntha. The inhabitants of the spiritual planets, headed by the Supreme Personality of Godhead himself, are certainly not deaf and dumb. They are in constant communication through unlimited transcendental bliss and knowledge. And the bona fide spiritual master can transmit the sound vibration of bliss and knowledge to his disciple. Just as a radio broadcasts mundane news, the bona fide guru broadcasts the news from Vaikuntha. This is confirmed by Narottam Das Thakur, Golokera Premadhana Harinama Sankirtana. The spiritual master also transmits to the disciple the holy name of Krishna, which is non-different from Krishna himself. The bona fide guru informs his disciple that every living entity is qualitatively one with the Supreme Lord, but quantitatively different, and thus engages the disciple in the loving service of the Lord. Because the living entity is qualitatively one with the Lord and is part of him, there is an eternal loving relationship between them. And because the living entity is quantitatively different, the relationship is eternally one of service. According to Sri Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, even though one may have the good fortune to accept a bona fide guru, highly qualified guru, if one maintains a taste for fruitive activities or mental speculation, one's advancement will be checked. But if a serious student surrenders to a bona fide spiritual master, there is absolutely no impediment to the transmission of perfect knowledge and bliss in the devotional service of the Lord. Om Jnanatimirandhasya Jnananjanashalakaya Chakshurunmilitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Nama Om Vishnupadaya Krishna Prashtaya Bhutale Srimate Bhakti Vedanta Swami Iti Namine Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Shatyadesha Tarine Vanchakalpatarubhyascha Kripasindhubhyayavacha Titanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Asadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama 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 Hare Hare. Hare Krishna. I seek the blessings of the senior devotees so that I can try to speak something on this very important verse and theme from the Bhagavatam. So here, the purpose of surrendering to the spiritual master is being talked about. Tasma, therefore. So therefore means there is some reasoning which is given earlier. Therefore one should surrender to Guru. What is therefore? The preceding that is that actually in the material world there is, whether in this planet or in higher planets, there is no enduring happiness. And therefore we should surrender to Guru. Tasmad Gurum Prapadyeta Jigyasuhu Shreya Uttamam. Being inquisitive about that which is our long term good. If there are two words I use, Shreya and Uttama. The word Shreya is often contrasted with the word prayers. Shreyas means that which is for our long-term benefit. So there is long-term fulfillment that comes. And there is prayers, which is short-term gratification or titillation that comes. Two other words which are used in the Vedic parlance are also Nishreyas and Abhyuday. Nishreyas refers to achievement. Sorry, Nishreyas refers to fulfillment and Abhyuday refers to achievement. So in today's world, there is an enormous emphasis on achievement. Now, what have you achieved? You know, I've got this many marks in my exam, I've got this much, I've got a job which pays me this much salary, I've got this big house, I've got this car. What have you achieved? That's what counts. And that's what people think that's what counts. But there are many people who have achievements, but they have no fulfillment. So achievement is a sense that I have done something, that this is what I can show tangibly what I've done. Yes, some of us may be able to do extraordinary things. Some of us may not be able to do. It depends on our abilities, our situations, our destiny. Many factors are involved. But when we define our self-worth solely by our achievements, then we may achieve something significant. But if there is no fulfillment within, then it all becomes pointless. So the Abhyuday is achievement. Nishreyas is fulfillment. And we need, it's not that we need only fulfillment or only achievement. We need both. I'll come back to this point. But let's go over the verse. Jigyasu Shreya Uttamam. So for Shreya, for that which brings fulfillment, one should inquire about that. Another word that is used is Uttamam. So the word Tama refers to darkness or ignorance. Uttama refers to that which takes one beyond darkness, beyond ignorance. So we inquire about that which is fulfilling and that which is illuminating. So Shreya refers to Jigyasu Shreya Uttamam. Inquire about that which is fulfilling and Uttama, that which is illuminating, that which takes us beyond darkness. And who can do this? Who can illuminate us to thus? Shabde Pare Chanishnatam. That there is the transcendental word of God. One who is expert in that. Shabde Pare, the transcendental words. Nishnatam. One who is expert in that. Brahmane Upasamashrayam. And not just expert in terms of verbal delivery, but it is in terms of living, in terms of knowing how to live life according to scripture. Brahmani Upasamashrayam. So Upasamashrayam means that actually when we take shelter of the Lord, then our infatuation with worldly things goes down. So the spiritual master knows scripture not only theoretically and expertly in terms of quoting from here and there, but also lives scripture in terms of being attached to the goal of scripture, being attached to the Lord. When Srila Prabhupada met George Harrison, at that time George Harrison was quite interested in Eastern spirituality and he had met several other teachers also. So he asked a question which is there for many people who are not connected with any particular path. They say, how do we know which is the right path? How do we know which is the right guru? So Prabhupada replied that, you know, you see what is the life of that guru. Scripture tells us Vedaishcha Sarvair Ahameva Vedya. By all the Vedas I am to be known. So scripture is telling us be devoted to Krishna. And then if there is some teacher, no matter, they may be teaching valuable things, they may be teaching useful things, but are they teaching us about transcendental knowledge? Are they themselves attached to Krishna? If they are not attached to Krishna, then they may be teaching some things and there may be some validity to it, but that is not transcendental knowledge. Today I'll focus on the theme of the difference between the mental and the spiritual. The mental, psychological, emotional, that's one aspect to it. And the spiritual, transcendental, devotion, that's another aspect. So I'll focus on this theme because in today's world, the word spirituality is very commonly used, and the word spiritual means whatever people want it to mean.
The word spiritual
has almost become bereft of any etymological content, in the sense that people may say, oh, my office is very spiritual. Okay, what does it mean? Oh, my boss is a very spiritual person. Good, huh? But what do you mean by that? Their idea of spiritual is that generally, if anything makes me feel good, if I feel nice, if I feel calm, if I feel relieved, if I feel peaceful, then that means it's spiritual. So I go to a mountain top, and there I may see such a beautiful sight, and people say, this is spiritual. But now it can be, I just 2-3 months ago, a month ago I came from a tour of the West. So when I was in Canada, the devotees took me to Niagara Falls, and when I was there, I was just looking around, reading what literature about it is there, to understand what it is all about. So I gave a talk over there also. But there, many people say that visiting Niagara Falls is a very spiritual experience for us. Now, what exactly is the spiritual aspect of it? So people go there, they see the sight, it's a lot, water falling down. And, you know, if we look at that, okay, it is a spiritual experience. What does spiritual mean? They simply think that, you know, something, some experience that is different from their normal experience, they call it spiritual. So, people live so close, often live in metropolitan environments where they don't see the beauty of nature, the serenity of nature. So, any experience which they get different from their routine experience, they call it as spiritual. So, and that's why I said that the word spiritual can mean many different things to different people. So, on what basis do we decide what does spiritual mean? There are two words. There is spirituality and there is spiritualism. Prabhupada doesn't use the word spiritualism very much. Spiritualism has a very different context. The Bhagavad Gita offers us a three-level vision of reality. That there is matter, there is mind, and there is consciousness. So that matter refers to physical things. Or we could say body, mind, and soul. Now this triad level of reality, three levels, this is different from the say Western or mainstream intellectual conception. So there, we often hear of word like mind over matter. Mind over matter means, they say that actually the way you think, the way your attitudes are, that will shape the reality. So often, when they use the word mind over matter, actually that is based on a philosophical misunderstanding, because mind is also matter. Mind is matter, although it is subtle matter. So what happens is that there is the body, there is a physical level of reality. And in mainstream discourse today, anything apart from the physical, that is referred to as spiritual. So, and the words mind and soul, they are often conflated. Conflated means they are confused together. Both of them are thought to be like the same. But they are different. So the mind is like the intermediate level of reality that connects spirit with physical matter. So sometimes when we use the word matter, we refer to the body. But the mind is also matter. So the body and the soul are connected through the mind. So the body is gross matter, the mind is subtle matter, and the soul is spirit. And the soul's characteristic is defined by consciousness. The soul's energy is consciousness. And that consciousness radiates from the soul through the mind into the body. And then it comes out. So that means the soul is the root of consciousness. R-O-O-T. And the mind is the root of consciousness. R-O-U-T-E. The soul is from where consciousness comes. And the mind is from where consciousness is channeled. So sometimes people say somebody is say absent-minded. Now when they're absent-minded, actually what has happened is that the soul is there, the consciousness is there. But say if somebody is sitting here right now and say I'm speaking, you are hearing. Now somebody is absent-minded. That means what has happened? Their body is here, the soul is also here, but the mind is somewhere else. And because the mind is the root of consciousness, so what has happened is the consciousness coming from the soul is rooted somewhere else. So it may be, oh, I have to go home and do this work, or maybe, you know, today there is this match is there, I want to go and watch this match, or whatever. So the mind gets rooted in that direction. So the mind is the root of consciousness, the a pathway of consciousness. And for most people, this differentiation between the mind and the soul is not very clear. And that's why anything different from the physical, anything from different from the gross material, they think of it as spiritual. So, spiritual is that which is connected with the soul. And now spirituality is actually big business also. I was giving a talk in a hospital in New Jersey, and thereafter that the head of the hospital, he said that many companies are now giving multi-billion grants to investigate the correlation between, say, mindfulness and health. And they found that, you know, if people become more aware, more mindful, then that helps in the healing process. And that's why there's a lot of interest in this. Now, the term mindfulness has been drawn from Buddhist literature. Although the concept of mindfulness is also compatible with the Gita's understanding. But generally, when people talk about mindfulness, they think of mindfulness as a very spiritual concept. It can be, but it is not necessarily. When people use the word mindful, it simply means be aware. Be aware. Okay, where are you? What are you doing? What happens? Our mind today is very agitated. That is a characteristic of Kali Yuga also. Upadrutaha. So the way upadrutaha is disturbed, the mind is agitated. When the list of characteristics of Kali Yuga are described, prayan alpayush sabha kalavasmin yugajana manda sumanda matayo manda bhagya ya upadruta. So ya is he, certainly. So all the characteristics are listed, but this last characteristic is listed with emphasis. Certainly. That means we may find people who are fortunate, we may find people who are intelligent, we may find people who are healthy, but still we'll find that they are disturbed. This is a defining characteristic of Kali Yuga, that people are disturbed and people seek relief from the disturbance of the mind. At one level, the disturbance is a characteristic of the material world itself, because in the world things are constantly changing, and change causes uncertainty, change causes fear, and we want relief. We want some shelter. So to some extent, anxiety is natural. A disturbance is natural. But in today's world, disturbance has been heightened to unnatural proportions, to an excessive amount. So what does that mean? That that the mind is not able to find any stable shelter. I was at a conference of science and spirituality, and one psychologist, he was giving statistics. He was talking about an anxiety epidemic. And he said, one significant feature of this anxiety epidemic is that normally anxiety is caused by uncertainty. If I have to catch a flight, and if I don't know whether I'll reach on time for the airport or not, then there's uncertainty because of that causes anxiety. So, now if we compare, say, the first world with the third world, say, in the third world, there is far more external uncertainty than in the first world. So, for example, in many parts of the third world, you turn on a power switch, you're not sure whether light will come or not. If we turn on a water tap, we don't know water will come or not. Now, relatively speaking, in the first world, there is certainty. So, if we say that anxiety is caused by uncertainty, and if uncertainty goes down, anxiety should go down. But paradoxically, it is in the first world that anxiety levels are higher. Not only is it that in the first world anxiety levels are higher, when people from the third world immigrate to the first world, their anxiety levels go up. So whenever I speak this in America, and many Indians are there in the audience, they all nod. They say, actually, our anxiety, we are more comfortable, but we are comfortably anxious.
You know, we are sitting in an AC room, physically are comfortable, but the mind is worried.
So what has happened? Why is it that if anxiety is caused by uncertainty, uncertainty has gone down, then why has anxiety gone up? Now that is because, you know, there is another factor for anxiety, another cause of anxiety. That outer uncertainty can cause anxiety, but more fundamentally, anxiety is caused by inner instability. So anxiety is at the level of the mind. So the mind is the intermediate between the body and the soul. So at the level of the body and outer things, if there's uncertainty, that will cause anxiety. But the mind is also connected with the soul. If there is inner instability, then that causes anxiety. By inner instability, that means that as the world has progressed in the technological sense, it is actually also regressed in the psychological sense. So how has it regressed? So there is, the world has progressed technologically, but it has regressed psychologically. Regressed psychologically means that there is greater affliction by problems at the psychological level, because the spiritual foundation of life has been removed from under people. Most people, whether in the East or the West, before the advent of the modern age, they had some spiritual understanding of life. They understood that life is meant for something more than just immediate bodily gratification. They understood that there is a higher meaning to life beyond what we achieve in this world. So they may not have been focused on the other world. The number of people who focus on the spiritual are always limited. Manushyanam sahasreshu, as Krishna says. But at least there is a background understanding that this world is not everything. And then if there is another world to be aspired for, so then what happens is, even in this world there is some uncertainty, there are ups and downs, they can be tolerated. But if there is no understanding of some higher goal to be aspired for, then if things go wrong in this world, then what is the point of living? And this has been the conclusion of most materialistic philosophers. So there's one, Friedrich Nietzsche, he said that, you know, best is to have never been born. Because life is so miserable. If at all you are born, then it's best that you die early. If you live on, then existence is misery. There's another philosopher, Albert Camus, he said that, he said, actually, life is misery. Therefore, the only philosophical question worth asking is whether to commit suicide tomorrow or today. And he wrote tomes of books and he says, don't commit suicide today. So, there is, when there is no understanding of a higher purpose to life, then at that time, when there are upheavals at the level of this world, then they can completely devastate us. Yes, when there are problems, we all feel disturbed by that, we all feel distressed by that. But the magnitude of that depends on our underlying conception of life. If my whole sense of identity and self-worth comes from my bank balance, And if the stock market crashes, then it's not just a crash of the stock market, it's a crash of my own self-worth. If I don't have this bank balance, what is the point of living? Who am I? I thought I was this multimillionaire person and I don't have that. Who am I then? So people just don't know what I'm living for. So people identify with a particular relationship. I am this person's partner, I'm this person's husband, this person's wife. And if that relationship doesn't work out, if that relationship is my defining identity, if it doesn't work out, then people get shattered. People either become suicidal or they become homicidal. Either they want to kill themselves or they want to kill the other person. So why? Because we all need some sense of meaning in our life. We have to have some sense of purpose, some foundation to our life. So when there is no spiritual foundation, then we get some other foundation to our life. And that foundation, whatever we get, it may be my marks, it may be my spouse, it may be my bank balance, it may be my looks, whatever is my foundation, that foundation is not stable. And when that foundation collapses, I have nothing to stand on. So anxiety can be caused by outer uncertainty, but it can also be caused by inner instability. When people don't have a stable foundation on which to base their identity. See, people may not have a conception of a soul, but everyone has a conception of the self. In a sense, the self is the soul. But people may not believe in the soul, people may not know about the soul, but everyone has some conception of the self. People talk about self-confidence, self-esteem. So, now, my conception of the self, what is it based on? So, if my conception of myself is based on, I'm such an intelligent person, that I can just remember anything, speak anything, I'm so brilliant, and then I find that I've got Alzheimer's. Who am I? Now, if my intelligence was the basis of my self-conception, and if I find my intelligence deteriorating, then I don't know what to base my life on. So like that, we all have some conception of the self. Now, if that conception of the self is not spiritual, if it is based on something else, then when that shakes, and we become not just shaken, we can become shattered. So anxiety in today's world is, even among in the developed world, in the first world, that anxiety is caused because people don't have a spiritual foundation to their lives. So whatever it is that they have, at one level they're very proud of it, they're very possessive of it, but another level, also know that it can go at any moment. We deny that reality forcefully, that it can all be stripped away. But, if we ask someone, are you going to die? Nobody will say that I'm going to live forever. But when people talk about death, they talk about it in a very abstract, remote sense. Almost as if it is going to happen in the distant future and it is going to happen to someone else. This American comedian Woody Allen, he said, it's not that I am afraid of death, I just don't want to be there when it happens. Now, we can't do like that. Death is an event that is going to happen to us. If I'm going to identify with my body and the body is going to be destroyed, then I'm going to experience the trauma of death. So, when people talk about death, even if they talk about it, we want to deny it. And one way we deny it is by thinking it is going to happen in the future, remote future, and it's going to happen to almost like someone else. So we talk about it in a very abstract sense. But even if we do that, there is this reality which is undeniable. And that gnaws at the foundation of our existence. And that's why, if we want to deal with anxiety, Yes, we can try to create some more certainty, more reliability in our life. So people, when they have anxiety, they take relief from anxiety through financial security. Like, you know, if I have more money, then I'll have more. If something goes wrong, I'll always have my bank balance to fall on. Yes, there can be financial security, there can be social security, there can be various kinds of security that are there. But if we do not have a spiritual foundation, if the search for security is ultimately the search for spirituality, the search for security is, it's not a search for money, it's not a search for one's own house, it's not a search for a stable job, it's not a search for a trustworthy partner, it's ultimately a search for spirituality. And so when people do not understand this, then what happens? That they need some stable foundation, which they don't have. So the external world agitates. And anything that can take people away from the external world, they call that as spiritual. So if anything makes me feel good, anything makes me feel peaceful, that they call as spiritual. Now yes, there are many things which can make one feel peaceful. And sometimes these methods of feeling peace, they may work also effectively. But there is a difference between pacification of the mind and purification of the mind. Pacification of the mind means that the mind is agitated and I calm it down. And when the mind is agitated, we do need to calm it down. But seven people say that, you know, if you just go to a scenic place, go to some hill station, go to some river, and you feel so peaceful, you feel so close to nature, feel calm. And yes, people do feel calm. And then there's some spiritual teacher, spiritual in double quotes. So they say that, you know, you mentally project yourself to a peaceful place. So before I was introduced to the Bhagavad Gita to Prabhupada, I was connected with another spiritual teacher. So he would say, he would do what is, for him, meditation was projection. This projection means when you sit and meditate, you project yourself mentally to your favorite place. So imagine, so he would sit, you know, and he had a very sweet, serene voice. So imagine you are on the banks of a river. The river water is flowing by smoothly. You can feel the breeze in your face. Your muscles are relaxing. The birds are chirping in the background. You can see a mountain on the other side. The clouds are touching the peak of the mountain. The trees are moving gently. You are peaceful. You are calm. You are whole. You are that. So now, when people do this exercise, actually, if you do this, and imagine that way, people do feel peaceful. So yes, there is pacification of emotions, pacification of the mind, that is possible by various means. But more than the pacification. So well, this whole projection is going on. One time, right, this projection was going on, and suddenly in the neighborhood there was an explosion. What happened? And then whole, everybody was like, is there a gunshot? Is there a bomb explosion? What happened? You know, people were sitting and meditating one moment, and next moment there was a stampede. Everybody was going out. So this is useful. If the mind is agitated, we can pacify it. But pacification is different from purification. So purification means we find out what is it that makes my mind agitated, and free my mind from attachment to that agitating object. So as long as we have material attachments, you know, as long as there's greed, there is pride, there is lust, there is anger, then These are the forces that are causing agitation of the mind. And if these forces are not dealt with, then even if there is pacification of the mind by some meditation, by some projection, soon after that, there will be agitation again. So what has happened is, the pacification is only temporary. There is no transformation. So when we stick only at the level of the mind, we equate the spiritual with the material, sorry, with the mental, and then we equate anything which makes me feel good, feel peaceful, we call it spiritual. Then we do get relief. But that relief doesn't last. What spirituality as is understood in the Bhagavad Gita is that the beyond the mental is the spiritual. And the mental needs to be directed toward the spiritual. That means our emotions need to be directed toward the supreme spiritual reality, that is Krishna. And when we direct our heart towards Krishna, when we become attached to Krishna, then that also brings pacification. But that pacification is through purification. That means when we are attached to Krishna, mai asattamana, Krishna says in 7.1 in the Bhagavad Gita, mai asattam, make your mind attached to me. Then it is not that we become neglectful or apathetic about the worldly things, but rather we have our vision fixed on something bigger than the world. So we understand that this world is big, but Krishna is bigger than the world. And when our attachment becomes fixed on Krishna, when there is no Krishna in our life, then the problems of this world can seem gargantuan. They can seem unmanageable. But bhakti means, so when pacification is done, all that is, okay, there are all these problems in the world, all these things which agitate you, just don't think about them. Think of something peaceful. Yeah, that's good. At least the agitation is stopping at that time. But what next? The problems are still there and the attachments are still there. The agitation is going to come back. But when the mind is attached to something higher, then there is not just pacification alone, there is purification. When we are attached to Krishna, Krishna is the supreme unchanging reality. And attachment to Him brings the supreme stability. Bhajahure mana Shinandanandana Abhayacharanaravindare. Abhayacharanaravinda. When we become attached to Krishna, when we make the mind fixed on Krishna, we become free from fear. We become free from anxiety. How does this happen? Because we become stabilized in our connection with Krishna. And it is this stable connection with Krishna that brings us stability, that brings us freedom from anxiety, that brings us serenity. So, when there is only pacification without purification, that is like taking a painkiller. When I have pain and I take a painkiller, the pain goes away. But actually it is not that the pain has been cured. The pain has only been covered. The pain has been covered, not cured. Like that, through various things which people call as spiritual but which are simply mental, we will get relief. But that relief will not last. Because what has happened is, it's simply pacification. It's not purification. Our attachment to that which we are attached to is still there. Our attachment to agitating things is still there. So, if after that, again I come back and again I become attached. So I may go to a serene place and I feel relaxed, I feel peaceful. Then I come back to the city and again I'm agitated. And again all those anarthas again start, all those anxieties, worries, they all start troubling me again and again. So then there is no transformation that has happened. In bhakti, also sometimes we may feel like that. We may feel that, you know, when I go to the temple, I feel very peaceful. You know, but when I go back again, my consciousness goes to the material things only. Sometimes I go to yatra, I feel like, you know, I've gone to the spiritual world. But then I come back from yatra, I find all my anarthas are still there. So is it that in bhakti also there is simply pacification, not purification? No, both are there. If we consider our own life, say a few years before when we had not started practicing bhakti, at that time, if we consider, we had so many more attachments. And you know, every attachment causes anxiety. If I'm attached to something as simple as drinking tea, and if I don't get tea, I get agitated. If I'm attached to watching a particular TV program, and if I don't get in time to watch the TV program, then there's so much agitation. So, you know, so if we consider, we may have some anxieties now also, we may have some agitation now also, but our attachments have gone down substantially, and the anxieties associated with the attachments have also gone out. Actually, the more there is attachment, the more there is anxiety. Chintam aparimelayam cha pralayantam upashita kamopabhoga parama etavadi nishchita. And 16.11 Krishna says that as long as there is kama, as long as there is desire to enjoy the external, then there will be anxiety caused by our inability to control the external. Now, I want money to enjoy, but money is not ultimately in my control. So then, money will cause me anxiety. So we will see that many of our attachments have indeed gone down. And comparatively speaking, our anxieties have also gone down. Yes, there are still anxieties because we are living in the material world. And when we experience relief, when we say come to a temple or when we go to yatra, it's not that, you know, we become purified then and we become impure again. It's not like that. What happens is when the environment is very spiritual, you know, that spiritual environment propels our consciousness further ahead than where it actually is. So that means in very intense spiritual environments, we get glimpses of advanced spiritual states. We are not there right now. So it is not that, you know, when we go to yatra, we become pure, and when we come back to city, we become impure. It's not like that. Our consciousness is on the gradual path to purification. But when we go in intensely spiritual environments, where we have vibrant spiritual association, where there is spiritual vibrancy in the environment itself, then that propels our consciousness forwards and gives us glimpses of advanced spiritual states. And when that external propelling force is no longer there, then our consciousness comes back to where it is. But that experience we got, that experience of, you know, just freedom from agitation, that experience of serenity, that experience of sublime spiritual sweetness, that can act as a inspiration for us. Yes, this is for real. I have experienced it myself. And if I persevere in the spiritual path, then I will experience this more and more and more. So the process of bhakti is what brings both pacification and purification. But the lasting relief from anxiety, the lasting satisfaction, that will come through purification. And purification requires consistent application. Now we steadily keep practicing bhakti, by that purification will gradually happen. Now, I'll talk two more points and I'll conclude, then we can have question and answers. First point is, sometimes, you know, in bhakti, so there is pacification and there is purification. So pacification is like the painkiller, and the purification is like the actual curative medicine. So when we are being treated, if we are in a lot of pain, we need both. We need pacification also, and we need purification also. And sometimes what is considered spiritual by many people today, that is only the painkiller. There's only pacification, but there's no purification over there. Now conversely, sometimes in our spiritual life, it may happen that there is purification, but there is no pacification. That means, you know, we may find that our bhakti practices are making us more agitated. Sometimes, you know, in the devotee community, there's some misunderstanding, or sometimes something happens in our spiritual life because of which we become agitated. So then we may feel, you know, I came to Krishna for peace, But it seems because of Krishna, my peace has gone away. So what is happening? What have I come here for? We have to understand that, you know, yes, we have come to Krishna for peace, but we have to come for Krishna for ultimate spiritual peace. It is not just temporary transitional peace. You know, when Prabhupada was in America in the 1960s, at that time the Vietnam War was going on, and there was a strong anti-war sentiment among the American youth, because they felt this war is just for for arms sales, and there is no purpose being served. So then Prabhupada was speaking on the Bhagavad Gita, which talked about a war, and people were very disturbed by that connotation. Arjuna is a nice peace loving person, so why is Krishna telling him to fight? So then one person asked Prabhupada the question. Most of the people who would come there were hippies, but there was one goldsmith. He was a lawyer who had incorporated ISKCON. And he said, Swamiji, why is God advocating violence over here? Shouldn't God advocate peace? So Prabhupada answered that, even if there is no violence, still there are hundreds of things that will take away your peace. So we think of peace and violence only as opposites. But even if there's no violence, all of us, we may not have physically experienced much violence, but can we say that we all experience peace all the time in our life? No. So physical violence is one thing that disturbs peace, but there are many other things that disturb peace also. Even there is verbal violence, there is mental violence. The mind gets agitated, that also disturbs our peace. Because somebody makes our mind agitated, that is mental violence, that also disturbs peace. So, to Prabhupada's point was very foundational. He says, don't think of peace simply in terms of external peaceful situation. Peace ultimately comes, not from an external calm situation, but it comes from an inner spiritual connection. When we are internally spiritually connected with Krishna, then we get real peace. Because that, in the Bible it is said, this is the peace that passeth all understanding. The peace that passeth all understanding. That means from the material perspective, it appears, there's no peace over here. This person is agitated. There's so much trouble. But internally, because there's connection with Krishna, there is peace at a deeper level. So, the point I'm making here is, that in bhakti also there is peace of mind, the pacification happens. But the real result of bhakti is not just pacification of the mind. It is purification of the mind by which there is attraction of the heart to Krishna. There is connection with Krishna. And so there is peace at the level of the mind and there is peace at the level of the soul. Peace at the level of the mind means that there are no agitating stimuli externally. There are no agitating emotions in the mind. But peace at the level of the soul means the soul is connected with Krishna. And the soul is secure. No matter whatever happens, Krishna will protect me. And sometimes to do that, sometimes what may happen? The pacification, the peace at the level of the mind may go away. Because of whatever circumstances are there. When that happens, we shouldn't think bhakti is not working. No. I'm getting so agitated. How is bhakti working? But actually, that is an opportunity for us to take shelter of Krishna and then experience spiritual peace. So bhakti will offer mental peace also. That means my mind will also become pacified by the practice of bhakti. But sometimes, even if the mind gets agitated, if we still connect with Krishna, we will realize that there is something beyond the mind. At a philosophical level, when you start practicing bhakti, it is easy to understand, I am not the body. But to understand I am not the mind, that takes some effort. And to distance ourselves from the mind. So what will happen is, there are some stimuli that agitate the mind. Some of us may be very sensitive to words. And somebody speaks one harsh word, we get very agitated by that. Now another person, they are not so sensitive. They just speak the word and they go away also. And they don't realize. It's like, they have caused an earthquake in our heart and they think they are in paradise. So what happens is we get agitated. And That is just the tendency of the mind. So, if we are particularly vulnerable, say, to verbal attacks, and we get very agitated by that, so that agitation will still be there. Just like, say, some people, you know, they may be physically a little weak. So, some people, they are punched. You know, some people, you punch them on the back and nothing happens. And just the thing is affection. Some people punch them on the back and they start coughing. You know, why did you punch so much, you know? So, different people have different physical levels of strength. So, like that, different people have different mental levels of strength. So, some of us may get more agitated by just some word that are spoken. So, when that happens, the mind is made in a particular way, and that may not change immediately. But if we take shelter of Krishna, then we will find that the magnitude of that agitation, the duration of that agitation will decrease. See, if I consider, you know, my mind gets agitated like a big wave. So I'm so agitated. That agitation will happen, but the agitation will not be so much in magnitude, and it will not be so long in duration. We'll come back to calmness quicker. So sometimes, in some situations, when a patient takes a painkiller and a medicine, the patient may feel, I'm quite okay. But when the painkiller is stopped, then the patient realizes, hey, you know, I am sick. I need the medicine. So what happens when we are practicing bhakti? Bhakti as a balance program. You know, materially also, if we practice bhakti nicely, our relationships also improve. We learn how to deal with people. We learn how to balance our work and home and our bhakti. And we find that many ways, even our material life will become more peaceful, better. But sometimes that may make us complacent. And then you may think, things are nice, you know. Krishna is happy there, I am happy here. Now, when we start, when a patient who is on painkiller starts thinking that I am okay, then what may happen, the patient may stop taking the medicine. So like that, when there is pacification of the mind, we may become complacent in our bhakti. So what happens is Krishna arranges things in such a way, the material world itself is constituted in such a way that suddenly things become agitated. And then at that time, we need to choose. You know, I'm practicing bhakti, still I'm agitated. So what is this? So then either I can go outwards thinking that bhakti doesn't work, I just become materialistic. But that is if I don't have proper philosophical understanding. If I have proper philosophical understanding, then I will go inwards. I'll go deeper towards Krishna. And then I'll experience that there is calmness even amidst the agitation. Yes, when this person spoke like this, this person had spoken like this 10 years ago, you know, I would have been fuming for weeks. But now, you know, I just calmed down within a day. What has happened? The agitation has gone down. So, we will see that there is a shelter beyond the state of the mind. That my state of the mind was agitated, but I found a shelter beyond that. So, that means what is happening? Sometimes Krishna takes away the painkiller. So that we realize how important the medicine is and we take the medicine wholeheartedly. So, when we find within bhakti we are agitated, it is not that the bhakti is not working. It is just that we need to go to a deeper level of bhakti. And so when people talk about mindfulness, you know, mindful, they think just being aware. In bhakti, to be mindful means to make the mind full of Krishna. You know, to make the mind full of Krishna, become attached to Krishna. And the second point I'll conclude with this is that, you know, there is a difference between cultural bhakti and spiritual bhakti. Cultural bhakti means that, you know, yes, bhakti is something which, you know, my parents did, my grandparents did, my community does, so I do it also. So when we practice bhakti simply because it is a part of our culture, it is good. At least we are coming to the temple, at least we are doing some bhakti activities. It's definitely better than being impious. But we may not have a very good philosophical understanding. So from the cultural bhakti to go to spiritual bhakti, what forms the bridge is philosophical bhakti. Philosophical bhakti means we understand philosophically how Krishna is the ultimate goal of life. He is the ultimate reality. Siddhanta baliya chitte nakare alas, iha haite Krishna lage sudrudha manas. Chaitanya Charitamrita says that don't think all this philosophy, you know, what is this? You know, I'm not interested in this. I come to temple for some peace of mind.
And you give such complicated classes. I come to temple to become refreshed, but I'm exhausted now.
So Siddhanta Balya Chitte Nakare Alas.
Hey, this is all philosophy. This is very tiring. I don't want it. No, don't be lazy like that. Understand philosophy. Why? What will happen? Iha haite Krishna lage sudrudhmanas. By this, by philosophical understanding, the mind will become firmly fixed on Krishna. Firmly, strongly, sudrudhmanas. Without philosophical understanding, you know, yes, Krishna bhakti is nice, but there are so many nice things in life. This is also one nice thing. Yes, there may be many nice things in life, but they are all temporary. Krishna is an entirely different category. So what happens is, without philosophical understanding, Krishna just remains one thing in the many things in our life. Yes, you know, there is sports, there is hobbies, there is this. Like this, there is Krishna also.
It's good, at least Krishna is there in that list. You know.
But you know, when Krishna is just one among the many things in our life, then actually we undertap the power of connection with Krishna. We can't fully benefit from the connection with Krishna, because Krishna is not just one thing among many things. Krishna is the one thing that underlies all other things. He is the foundation of everything. And what does it mean practically? How will it make a difference? See, when we practice bhakti at a cultural level, our self-conception remains largely material. I think I am a businessman. I think I am a housewife. I think I am a mother. I think I am this and that. And then we identify with whatever roles we are playing in the world. And then whenever there is agitation and trouble in the roles, we become shattered by that. But when there is proper philosophical understanding, then we practice bhakti at a spiritual level. Practicing bhakti at a spiritual level means it changes our self-conception. Practicing bhakti is not just about chanting Hare Krishna, coming to a temple, you know, going for yatras. All these are wonderful, they're essential. But this should change our self-conception. Self-conception means I understand that I am a part of Krishna. I am a servant of Krishna. And as a servant of Krishna, you know, I am the husband of someone, I am the wife of someone, I am the father of someone, I am employee in this company, I am the boss of this company. Whatever other roles we have, we see them as services. Narad Muni says, bhakti means sarvopadhi vinirmuktam. Remove, become free from all designations. So, if I identify, if my first identity is with my designation, if I identify myself as the mother of someone, and then if my child is going on the wrong track, child is not listening to me, and I feel, you know, my whole life is a failure. What did I achieve? But no. You know, my first identification should be, I am a servant of Krishna. As a servant of Krishna, Krishna has sent this child in my life, and I will try to serve this child. I'll try to care for this child. I'll help this child to grow in a proper way. But we are meant to do many services in our life. And sometimes there are factors beyond our control because of which some services work, some services don't work. Even for Srila Prabhupada himself, you know, he was a pure devotee with a completely pure desire to share Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's, Krishna's message, to share, fulfill Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's prophecy. But even for him, there were so many reversals, so many things that didn't work out. He started a business. His purpose was to assist his spiritual master's mission by financial contribution. It didn't work. Somebody cheated him. Things went wrong. Then he started organizing. He started League of Devotees. And the very people who were supporting him, they worked against him. And that which was going to be his international headquarters, he was practically evicted from there. He tried so many things. He went to America, and the person, David, who was going to become his first disciple, he went mad in a drug-induced mania and came to attack Prabhupada. Prabhupada had to flee from there. So, You know, today is Guru Purnima, and Prabhupada is the paramount example of Guru for us. And we see that even in his life, there are so many things which he tried which didn't work out. So, but what was his determination never failed. Now, empowerment doesn't mean absence of obstacles. It doesn't mean absence of failures. Empowerment means perseverance amidst obstacles and perseverance amidst failures. Prabhupada had many obstacles and many failures also in external sense. Internally, whatever he was doing was pleasing Krishna, and in that sense it was always successful. But externally, then things didn't work out. So when we practice, we have philosophical understanding and we practice bhakti at the spiritual level, then we identify ourselves as servants of Krishna. And whatever we are doing, it is a service to Krishna. So I have a job, and in this job which I am doing, it's a service to Krishna. Sometimes people think, what if I lose my job? If I lose my job, then how will I pay the mortgage for my house? If I can't pay the mortgage for my house, then I'll be on the streets. Oh no, if I'm on the streets, what will I do? Well, right now I'm sitting in an AC room, but I'm worrying what will happen if I go on the streets. That's just the mind is taking us on a wild ride. So if I identify myself, I'm a servant of Krishna. As a servant of Krishna, I'm doing this job. Okay, if this job doesn't work out, something goes wrong, I'll take up something else. No, Krishna will provide for his devotees. Mabhir manda mano vichintaya daudayamishchiram yatana naivami prabhavanti paparipava swami nanu shridhara alasyam vyapaniya bhakti sulabham dhyayasvanarayanam lokasya vyasanapanodan karo dasyasya kim nakshamaha. Mukundmala Sutta, Kulshekar Maharaj prays, oh my dear mind, don't worry so much. Mabhir manda mano, oh mind, you are so lazy in doing work, but you are very busy in anxiety.
So the mind is lazy in working and busy in worrying.
So mabhir manda mano vichinte, mind don't worry so much. In his context he's talking about bahudha yamish chiram yatna. I may think that, you know, I had done so many sinful activities and so many reactions are going to come. How will I deal with them? Don't worry about it. Why? Naivami prabhavanti paparapavaha swami nanu shridhara. Don't you know that your Lord, who is he? He is two qualities that is called paparipavaha. He is the enemy of sin. Where he is present, sin and sinful reactions, they have to flee away. And not only that, he is Shridhara. He is the Lord of the goddess of fortune. So he is the enemy of sin and he is the Lord of the goddess of fortune. And he is your Lord. So why are you worried? And he says, lokasya vasanapanodan karo. People in general who are not even really devotees, they come to him, and thousands of people come to the temples, mosques, churches, they go and pray, and you know their prayers are many times answered. That's why they keep coming. So even people in general, the Lord fulfills their desires. Then dasyasya kim nakshamaha. Then somebody who has devoted oneself to serving the Lord, why will the Lord not protect that devotee? So therefore, alasyam vipaniya bhakti sulabham dhyayasvanarayanam. Alasyam vipaniya, give up laziness. Don't be lethargic, don't be apathetic. Bhakti sulabham, bhakti is very easy. Just by the easy process of bhakti, dhyayasvanarayanam. Absorb yourself in Krishna, meditate on Krishna. When we absorb ourselves in Krishna, we will find that whatever happens, in the world many things will go wrong, but Krishna will always be with us. And in the connection with Krishna, there will always be shelter. So Krishna is the supreme spiritual reality, and the supreme purpose of spirituality is to connect us with the supreme reality. So rather than getting enamored by some conceptions of spiritual, which may seem to be practically beneficial, but which are not transformational, we focus on the pure spiritual conception, which is both transformational and ultimately transformational and ultimately supremely beneficial. So I'll summarize. I spoke today about how we should go to a spiritual master for inquiring about Shreya Uttama, that which is fulfilling and that which is illuminating. So, in life today, people pursue achievement, Abhyuday, but they don't pursue Nishreya's fulfillment. If we achieve a lot, but we don't get fulfillment, then we will be dissatisfied. And we should pursue that knowledge which illuminates us, gives us a clear understanding of reality. Uttama. So, and then my focus of the class was on this Tama part, that one part of the darkness in today's world is that people equate the mental and the spiritual. So anything which is different from their routine experience, everything that makes them, anything that makes them feel good or calm, they call it as spiritual. But the Bhagavad Gita explains that beyond the physical, there are two levels. There is mental and there is spiritual. And the soul is the root of source of consciousness, and the mind is the root, the pathway of consciousness. And real spirituality is that which connects, is not just at the level of the mind, at the level of the soul, which connects us with the Supreme Soul, Krishna. So, when people practice whatever they call as spirituality, that may sometimes bring pacification of the mind. But that is like a painkiller. So, we need not just pacification, but purification. So agitation is caused not just because the external circumstances are agitating, but agitation is caused because we are attached to things that are uncertain, that are unstable. So I talked about how anxiety is caused, can be caused by external uncertainty. But even when external uncertainty has gone down in the first world, still there is anxiety. Why? Because there is inner instability. Inner instability means people don't have a solid self-conception. Their sense of self-identity is not based on something stable and spiritual. So when their sense of self-identity is based on something external, it may be their wealth, it may be their family, it may be their intelligence, their looks, then because this can be lost anytime, so there is existential anxiety. And the reason for this anxiety is that externally things are temporary. Death is unavoidable. And we cannot wish death away. We deny death by thinking that it will happen to someone else or some other time, and it's almost like I won't be there. No, death is going to happen to us. So what we need to do is, we need to understand that the self is the soul. The self and our self-conception should be based on our understanding of the soul. The soul is indestructible. The soul is a part of Krishna. And when bhakti, what we do is, just going beyond pacification to purification, to getting the soul to become attached to Krishna. And that brings the ultimate pacification. So in bhakti, we get pacification and purification both. So sometimes when there is intense spiritual environment around us, at that time, we experience spiritual emotions far ahead of what our level is. So it is not that we were spiritual and again we became material. Rather, we got advanced experiences of spirituality. So in that sense, what we experience in bhakti is different from what people experience by shallow forms of spirituality. They feel peaceful in peaceful circumstances or just projecting oneself a peaceful place. But again, when their mind gets agitated, when the world creates some agitating stimuli, they get agitated again. But in bhakti, it is our heart that is being redirected towards Krishna. And that is what brings ultimate pacification. So sometimes, it may seem that in bhakti, the pacification is not coming, rather agitation is coming because of bhakti. So that is like if a patient becomes complacent because of the painkiller and doesn't take the medicine very seriously. The painkiller is stopped. And then, I'm sick, I need the medicine. So there is peace of mind and there is the peace of the soul. Sometimes when the peace of mind goes away, then we have to choose. You know, either we can just give up bhakti and go back into material life, or we can go deeper into bhakti beyond the mind to the level of the soul. And then if we take shelter of Krishna by serious practice of bhakti, if our mind is vulnerable, say, to verbal attacks, we will be agitated still. But the magnitude and duration of that agitation will become much lesser because we have spiritual shelter. And lastly, I talked about how We need to go beyond cultural practice of bhakti to spiritual practice of bhakti through philosophical understanding. When we practice cultural bhakti, we still identify ourselves at the material level as a professional, as a whatever material designation is. And when that designation is threatened, we feel agitated. But in this, with philosophical understanding, when we identify ourselves as servants of Krishna, then we see everything that we do, all our relationships, all our work, all our occupation, vocation, whatever, as a service to Krishna. And some services will work out, some services won't. But that doesn't affect our self-identity. Because I am stable as a servant of Krishna. And even for Prabhupada, also, not all the services that he started worked out. So empowerment doesn't mean absence of obstacles or reversals. It means perseverance amidst obstacles and reversals. And when we are philosophically grounded in understanding that Krishna is the ultimate reality and I am his part, I am his servant, then no matter how much ups and downs come in our life, we will stably move towards, we will be founded in the peace that passeth all understanding, and a sublime spiritual peace that will help us to face with no matter the biggest problems that life may send. So, with bhakti philosophy we understand, this last thought for conclusion, that when nothing is left, Krishna is still left. And he is our ultimate shelter. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. Any questions or comments? Yes, please. Yeah. You can send the mic there. I can just hear the question. You can send the mic there. Okay. Yes, please. You can ask the question to them. Okay. Okay. So, in Bhagavatam, we see many devotees renounce their family, renounce the world, and focus exclusively on bhakti. But say, in other traditions, or say in Pandharpur and Vitthal, you know, it is that a devotee is serving his parents, and the Lord is waiting for him to complete his service to his parents, and then the Lord waits for the service. So, how do we understand this? There is an essential principle of bhakti and there is a contextual application of bhakti. So if we see this, even in the Bhagavad Gita and the Bhagavatam itself, you see this difference. The Bhagavad Gita, there's practically no verse which endorses strongly renunciation of the world. Krishna talks about how the yogi is going to the jungle, but then in the sixth chapter, but then he says, Arjuna, you practice bhakti. Bhakti is an easier way to control the mind. And his bhakti means you ma manusmara yudhyacha. You remember me and you fight. So the context of the Gita is that Arjuna, for him dharma is to fight the war. For him he needs to be engaged. And because he needs to be engaged, for him renunciation is not appropriate at that time. So the essential message of bhakti is that we have to devote ourselves to the Lord. But for Arjuna, that devotion is through his dedication to his duties in this world. Now, in contrast, if you see in the Bhagavatam, Parikshit Maharaj has been cursed to die in 7 days, and he has also accepted the curse. He decided, I'm not going to try anything to counter it. Then, the whole thrust of the Bhagavatam is just renounce the world. Just focus on Krishna. Everything is a distraction. To think that, you know, we are the protectors of anyone, we are the maintainers of anyone, that's an illusion. And say the story of Bharat Maharaj is told, how he tried to protect a deer and he got distracted by that. But we see that same Parikshit Maharaj, when he was ruling as a king and when a cow and a bull were being attacked, he did not think, you know, oh, if I try to protect this cow and bull, I'll become attached to them, so I should not try to protect them. That time he intervened. So the context of the Bhagavatam is, it's helping a person to prepare for death. At that point, know, everything in this world is a distraction. So there is single-pointed focus on the other world. So the contextual application of bhakti for Parikshit Maharaj is very different from the contextual application of bhakti for Arjuna. So today's example, today's world, we could say, this is some young energetic devotee. Maybe the devotee is frustrated because of some difficulty in service. The devotee says, no, I'll just go to Vrindavan and I will chant 128 rounds every day. You know, now he'll tell the devotee, no, you know, don't do that. You have youth, you have energy, you'll just become a sahajiya by that. And better stay here, do some other service. The service didn't work out. We'll encourage that devotee to be actively engaged in doing service. Now, on the other hand, say some devotee has got cancer and it's terminal, it's incurable. And then that devotee, there's no chance of recovery. And that devotee starts thinking, you know, okay, you know, I was managing this project, who will take care of this, I will. And then the devotee is guiding them, they'll just forget that now. No, it's Krishna's mission, Krishna will take care. So you focus on fixing your mind on Krishna. So there is context which is very important in understanding content. You know, if we take the content without the context, we can misapply and we can make a mess of things. So, in as I said, what would be appropriate for us? So, in that particular context, now that story of Vitthal is told, but we don't. It's just that much. That story is primarily told to talk about how Vitthal is standing on a brick. But beyond that, you know, what? It's quite likely that the parents of that particular bhakta were also great devotees. And by serving them also, he was serving his parents. And was it that for him it was a choice between, it was not a life-changing decision. Whether I serve my parents first and then I serve the Lord, or whether I serve the Lord first and serve my parents. So we can't take that example as a basis for deciding how we can practice bhakti. That example is an illustration. But we have to understand the essential principle of bhakti is that I am meant to serve Krishna. And then in my context means my familial context, my social context, my psychophysical context, I have to find out how best I can serve Krishna. So if I can serve Krishna by renouncing the world and practicing bhakti as a renunciate, that's wonderful. If I can practice bhakti best by being engaged in the world as a householder, that's also wonderful. So from the bhakti perspective, whatever is anukul, we take that. And whatever is pratikul, we avoid that. Does that answer your question? Thank you. Yes, Prabhuji.
Haribol. Haribol, Prabhuji. Hare Krishna. 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 Thank you so much for the class. Prabhuji, we learn in various classes in the temple that we must not give up. I mean, we should continuously strive in devotional service. We may end up in failures, however we should continue. However, in the example that we learned that, yes, Prabhupada, he wanted to serve his spiritual master financially and his business failed and he gave up that business. I'm not casting any opinion, but at what level should a person, a devotee, decide that yes, I should not pursue beyond this and yes, this is not meant for me?
So we sometimes told that we should never give up, we should keep persevering in our service to Krishna. But then we see Prabhupada was doing his business and then at one particular point he decided to just stop it and do some focus on direct service to Krishna. So at what point can we decide that this is enough, this is not for me and I should do something else? There is the intention to serve and there is the form of service. So for a devotee, the form of service can change according to time, place, circumstance. The intention to serve doesn't change. So Srila Prabhupada writes in a purport that a devotee may be perplexed, but a devotee is never discouraged. Perplexed means that I don't know what to do. Should I be continuing with this service or should I do some other service? That kind of indecision, that is perplexity. But discouragement means that I don't want to do anything only. I just don't want to serve Krishna. I don't want to do anything. So a devotee is never discouraged. Devotee's intention to serve Krishna never wavers. That is always strong. Specifically how we serve Krishna, that has to be determined by time, place, circumstance. The example is, Kunti Maharani says, Gange Vaugham Udanvati. He says, the Ganga flows towards the ocean, Matir Madhe Matir Madhupate Sakrata Temudvata Dagdha. And so she says that, Paime Ananya Vishaya, just let my mind constantly flow towards you. He says, the Ganga flows towards the ocean. Now, the Ganga's flow towards the ocean is not always straight. You know, if we look at a topographical map of India, and we see Ganga, it's not like moving a straight line. And like this, like this, like this, like this. It's a winding journey. Because the topography over the, at a particular place may not be conducive for the river flow. Then the river will move this way, move that way. So, its intention is to keep moving towards the ocean. But exactly how it moves towards the ocean, that will be shaped by the territory around it. So like that, our goal is always to serve Krishna. But how specifically we serve Krishna, you know, whether a particular ashram we serve, whether a particular service we do, particular, say if we are doing preaching, particular preaching program we do, we are taking a particular responsibility, particular department, should I continue in that, should I do something else? That's something which we have to decide based on time, place, circumstance, the Ishkala Patra. So such decisions should be taken in the mode of goodness, not in the mode of passion or ignorance. That means, say, if I have experienced frustration in a service, and I have tried and I just, again and again there have been obstacles and I have not been able to do it. Then if I give up the service because of frustration, then sometimes that kind of giving up of a particular effort may be in the mode of ignorance. So now yes, it's possible that, you know, that this particular service requires a particular frame of mind or a particular nature or a particular talents which I don't have. So it may be best that I don't do the service, somebody else does that service. But that recognition need not be born primarily out of frustration. That recognition can also be born from reflection. So if I'm in frustration, I give it up because I can't do it. And I start feeling that I'm worthless, I'm good for nothing. But when I'm in the mode of goodness, when we, before taking any major decision in our life, you know, we pray, we chant, we get ourselves in a calm, reflective state of mind, and then we objectively analyze the various parameters. You know, okay, if I do this, this is advantage, this is disadvantage. If I do this, this is advantage, this is disadvantage. And then, based on that, then we arrive at a decision. Then that that decision is based on, not because I can't do this I give it up, but because, you know, there are other things which I can do and I would be better able to contribute to other things. So that's why I give this up. There's a difference between, say, frustration and renunciation. Frustration is because I can't do this I give it up. Renunciation means because I have something higher to do, that's why I give this up. So the focus is very different in the two cases. So as devotees, we need to do due reflection. And we can of course consult senior devotees. They will also give us a different perspective on things. And generally it's best not to take this decision, kind of decision instantaneously. They can gradually say, if the thoughts are in the mind, get them out, write them down. And when we write things down, when the thoughts are inside the mind, they just create congestion. You know, should I do this? Should I not do this? It's like a constant, the mind is in an auto loop. Do this, not do this, do this, don't do this, do this, don't do this. I just don't get anywhere. So get the thoughts out of the mind, write them down, and then just the distance between us and the thoughts, it gives some objectivity. Yeah, this makes sense. You know, this is not really valid. This I need to get more information about this. This I'll have to consult someone else. And then basically when we write things down, we get a snapshot of our mind, a picture of our mind, and of our mental state basically. And if we decide that this is a major decision in my life, I'm not going to take it one day, let me do reflection on this for the next 6 months. Then we don't constantly keep thinking about it, because see, serious issues, life changing decisions, they cannot be a result of background thinking. That means, you know, I'm doing this job, I'm doing this, and that time I start thinking of this. Major issues, if you start thinking that way, That sort of thinking simply drains us. It doesn't illumine us. It just confuses us more. So, when the thought of should I do this, should I not do this, that thought comes in the mind, then instead of, we decide every week, maybe this is important, maybe 1 hour, I'll sit and think about this. So write everything down, and if in the week, course of the week, any new thought comes, new idea comes, just note it down, don't think too much about it at that time. And then, at the end of a week, when we have some time, then add that and think about it once again. And then what I have written earlier, I'll be able to bring reflection back to it and see, okay, this is a valid point, I didn't think about this. And then if we do it for a persistent period of time, basically what are we doing by this? You know, by this we are making our intelligence the counselor of our mind. You know, the mind is saying this, but then how valid is it? I have to use my intelligence to evaluate it. So I use my intelligence, yeah, this is a valid point, this is not a valid point. And then if we keep doing this regular reflection for a few months, after 6 months I find that the overall way I was thinking at the start of the 6 months is the same as I am thinking right now after 6 months. That means this is not just some passing desire that has been born from circumstantial frustration. This is something which is a lasting inclination, enduring inclination within me. This is something which I strongly want to do. So then, when we have done this due reflection, then after that, whatever decision we take, we will take it with confidence and we will execute it with conviction. Otherwise, we take some decision on the impulse, on the force of the moment, and afterwards, even when we are doing something, we may have taken the right decision, but we are second guessing ourselves. You know, maybe I should not have done this. Maybe I should have done this. So then even the right decision will not be executed rightly because we are half-hearted in it. So it's best that we take major decisions when we are in the mode of goodness and do due reflection in the mode of goodness, and then we take decisions like this. So it's not that one form of service is right and another is wrong. We have to see what is right for me. With the devotees who are associated with this form of service, they may tell me, you should do this service only. Devotees are associated with that form of service, they say, you should do this, come here. So we can't let ourselves be buffeted around by opinions of others. We take input from others' opinions, but ultimately it is we who have to do our service. So it is we who have to live the life. You know, it is even our spiritual master. Even our spiritual master cannot live our life for us. Now, I have to live my life for me. My spiritual master will guide me, and the instructions are very important, but I have to live my life. So then we have to be ourselves convinced about the course of action. We consult others, but it is based on our conviction that we make the decision. And then whatever decision we make, based on what is anukul for our bhakti, what is favorable, we do that, and we may either continue the same form of service or we may change over to a different form of service. Does that answer your question? Thank you. So, shall we stop here? Thank you very much. Grantra Srimad Bhagavatam ki, Srila Prabhupada ki, Gaur Bhakta Vrinda ki, Utai Gaur Premanande.